everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on current events when we come back. You know, when you're making $50,000 a year, you're paying $7,650 a year in Social Security taxes. Then you pay a 17% income tax on that $50,000. That's another $8,500, which means you just paid an extra $1,300 by paying your tax on a tax. Now, that makes the real effective Social Security tax rate 17.8%. It's not the 15.3% that's being advertised. Now, isn't that just real special? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Help take a bite out of crime. Why don't you call and ask for our free general law CD package? It's a four-hour commentary on the law school. Remember, it's entertaining. It's educational. It's informative. Best of all, it's free. That number, again, is 417-273-4967. Now, tax and status is available on compact disc for adult home education. That's the school, tax and status. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? Hey, we've been talking about, in current events here, we've been talking about some of the news stories that you don't hear about on the mainstream press. Every once in a while, I like to pick up a number of these stories that come through, typically written by people like Richard Benson, Benson's Economic and Market Trends. He wrote a piece here on inflation and the ironic productivity tax. Productivity tax. The inflation tax. If you bought stocks back in 1960 and you kept them up through 2000 for that 40-year period, you lost money. If you're just average Joe Sixpack buying stocks, stocks have never made money. They're touted as being over the long haul, always money makers, and they're not lying to you when they tell you that stocks have always made money. And at the same time, it's a lie because you lost your shirt. Well, not exactly your shirt, but you lost some money in the process. You lost your purchasing power to inflation. Here's the way that works. Stocks increased in value, in total dollar value, 4.8% for the 40 years, compounded annually. That's pretty good. If you were to compound 5% annually, every 14.7 years, your capital would double. So if you had $1,000 in the bank at 5% interest compounded for 14.7 years, it would turn to $2,000 over that period of time. If that $2,000 was left in the bank for another 14.7 years at 5% compounded annually, it would multiply to $4,000. So if you left it in there for 45 years, that's 15, 30, 45, that's three doubling cycles at 5% interest, it would go from $1,000 to $2,000 to $4,000 to $8,000 in 45 years. That's pretty significant, isn't it? And that's what happened with your stocks. They went from, now let's just take that $1,000 we invested in stocks in 1960. By 1975, you had $2,000 worth. By 1990, you had $4,000, and by the year 2005, 45 years later, you'd have $8,000. Now, when we factor in inflation, inflation ran at 4.8%. Now, I said the stocks grew 4.8. Actually, the stocks grew by 5%, and your inflation grew at 4.8%, just 0.2% less than the rate of increase that you were making on your stocks, and the tax rate was 28% on capital gains. So you take the $8,000, you know, you made one, 2, 4, 8. You took your 1, multiplied to 2, went to 4, went to 8. Now take 28% of the $8,000. Just do it here quickly. $8,000 times 0.28 is $2,240. So you take $2,000 off your 8 and you ended up with 6. $6,000. You ended up with less dollars than you did when you invested your money in 1960. And then you lost your money to the purchasing power. And that's what nobody counts. That's what nobody is taught in Economics 101 in college to factor in, and that is the purchasing power. Now, from 1865 to 1900, we went through a period of deflation. It was the highest growth rate in American history, 35 years of growth. From the Civil War to 1900, America built 286,000 miles of railroad. It was the biggest expansion in the history of the nation in any 35-year period. If you'd have put $1,000 in the bank in 1865, in 1900, that $1,000 would have had $1,200 worth of purchasing power. It would have bought $200 more than it would have bought in 1865 in actual goods and services. If you take a look at your money from 1960 to the year 2000, in that 40-year period, your money lost its purchasing power. And here's how much it lost. From 1980 to 2000, in that 20-year period, the purchasing power of the dollar went down by 50%. So things that cost a dollar in 1980 cost a dollar and a half in 2000. From 2000 to 2005, just in that 5-year period, well, 6-year period, take 2000 and add 5 more years to it, that's a 6-year period, you lost 30% of the purchasing power of the dollar. If you look at the long-term loss in purchasing power from 1930 to the present time, you've lost 98% of your purchasing power. It now takes a dollar to buy what 2 cents would buy in 1930. That's the insidious tax called the inflation tax that we all pay, whether we like it or not, in addition to your income tax, Social Security, property taxes, gasoline taxes, Medicare taxes, unemployment taxes. When you add all these taxes up, you have 14 major or basic taxes that you pay. 14. Now, those 14 taxes, if you were paying the maximum rate on all 14, would take 74% of everything that you create and produce. And those 14 taxes do not include the inflation tax. So Richard Benson wrote a little piece on inflation and the ironic productivity tax. He said that man is such a lucky creature because machines do all of our work. Our economy and prosperity stand on the shoulders of the geniuses who invented the wheel, the lever, and the plow, and the creative thinkers who dreamed up mathematics, the internal combustion engine, silicon chips, and the internet. Now, these innovations have led to wondrous and unforeseen leaps forward for mankind. Human ingenuity mixed with a desire to do better and to produce more with less has relentlessly driven productivity forward. There was a time when I actually looked forward to the government's reports on productivity because it made me feel that I could share in the collective genius, the good luck, and the hard work of my fellow man. Then I woke up and I realized that those very reports were being used to rob me. Now, here's how I came to that conclusion. The other day, while I was at the gas pump, I was thinking about productivity, creativity, and technological advances. Then I realized how much it would cost me to fill up my sport utility vehicle, an amount that would have led a family of four for a month or fed a family of four for a month when I was a kid. It dawned on me that the one thing that our government never reports is that the dollar in my pocket will buy me more next year. Indeed, my dollar should buy more next year because of the relentless increases in productivity. And I should, in reality, be better off if I saved my money rather than spent it. But in my lifetime, my world has only known inflation. So buying goods today that I will need tomorrow and then stashing the goods away has proved to be a better investment than actually saving the cash in the bank, even though the bank pays me interest on the cash that I save. Now, even though my wallet was noticeably lighter after paying the bill to fill up my car, I proceeded to go to the supermarket. Regardless of all of the gains in productivity, everything on the supermarket shelves, and I mean everything, was more expensive than the last time I shopped at the same supermarket. And a nagging thought kept bothering me. If mankind's machines produce more with less labor every year, then why shouldn't the dollar I make this year buy more next year? Shouldn't this increase in productivity flow through to the wage earner and the saver? Now, this brings me to a serious examination of inflation, because I'm a trained economist. And I know that inflation is the government's and the Federal Reserve Bank's way of taxing financial assets like cash. And I also realize that inflation is a horrible and an insidious silent tax. And I even encouraged my wife to purchase inflation-indexed I-bonds so that she would at least be able to keep up with inflation. But perhaps those I-bonds haven't kept up with inflation, with what I see to be real inflation, which is not the same inflation that's measured by the government's Consumer Price Index. There's the government's statistics, and then there's reality. So, anyway, back to the supermarket. Here I was rolling the cart up and down the aisles. I was stunned at the cost of the simple groceries that we buy every day. We're not even talking about the price of meat pushed up by the price of cattle, hogs, and chickens, which has been pushed up by the price of corn. Now, corn has been pushed up because some Washington politicians think that turning all of the corn into ethanol for use in cars is popular. But I view this as incredibly stupid, unless, of course, you like higher food prices. So as a consumer, when I think about the escalating cost of food today, I realize that I really didn't benefit at all from all of those productivity gains. And meanwhile, with inflation, the government has basically stolen or taxed all of my share of this increased productivity away. Now that's a stunning and a painful thought. Shopping was so stressful that I needed to go home to rest. And just as I'm drifting off, reality hits me like a ton of bricks between the eyes. Now, I've been writing for years about how the government has been using hedonic price adjustments to hold down the reported inflation rate. And one way inflation measures are modified over time is in the way in which goods from the present are compared with goods from the past. So let's use the purchase of your computer as an example. The concept behind this governmental approach to hedonic adjustment is that because your computer is twice as fast and stores twice as much data for the same price today, the price that you paid then is cut in half. The actual price that you paid for the computer is not cut in half, but the price as reported in the consumer price indexes is cut in half. Well, surprise of surprises. Most of what passes for hedonic adjustments in the price indexes is simply another way of reporting the improvements in technology. Another name for this is, of course, productivity. Technological advances, hedonics, and productivity are all names and measures for the same fundamental fact. Technological advance allows for the increase in productivity that is translated into this hedonic adjustment. Now, something just didn't feel right, so I got up and I examined the shrinking dollar in my wallet, and I felt like I had been robbed, first by the Federal Reserve Bank because they have kept inflation moving ahead, so I never received the benefit of productivity, and then by the slick Bureau of Labor Statistics, they call it the BLS, that actually made the price index pay for productivity by subtracting it from the CPI and then reporting it as a smaller number than it really is. Now, it's ironic that the best and the brightest at the Bureau of Labor Statistics are employed to figure out how to use fancy statistics to rob their grandparents of their Social Security increases. Now, if our government was fair and money and credit growth were restrained, I estimate the dollar could purchase about 2% more each and every year, and we could be living in a saver's paradise. Taking productivity out of the price index means that when the CPI shows 3%, in reality it's more like 5% or more. Our government gains by doing this because as the world's largest borrower, the government benefits from increases in productivity. On the other hand, savers and those on fixed incomes really get ripped off. In a $14 trillion economy, the 2% productivity ripoff is likely to amount to a cool $280 billion. And the total inflation tax on 5% is over half a trillion dollars. Now, that's enough tax revenue to pay for the cost of not so little a war, such as the war in Iraq. Now, I'm working, and I'm making a great living, so why should I, of all people, complain because the inflation tax is cruel and because of productivity being perversely subtracted from inflation? Well, the reason that I'm concerned is that I'm getting older, too. And my heart goes out to the retired couple next door on fixed income, knowing full well that their cost of living is adjusted down every year because of the productivity tax called inflation. If there was no increase in productivity, the government would have to pay the retired couple more since the hedonic adjustment reducing inflation would be zero. If the hedonic adjustment was zero along with zero productivity, the same retired couple might be able to stay even with the real cost of living. But for people on fixed incomes, technological advance leading to increased productivity is a curse rather than a blessing. So when looking forward, it is important to remember that whenever productivity slows down, inflation will suddenly pick up because there is no hedonic adjustment or productivity adjustment to subtract from that real number. Now that I clearly understand how this productivity tax works, I am less inclined to buy inflation-indexed bonds, and I am more inclined to buy gold or silver or wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. And I believe that precious metals are more likely to track the real inflation numbers, and that the goods themselves are of more value to me than the dollars in the bank. The government's phony numbers are used to hide and to pretend that the inflation tax is much lower than it really is. Now, given the size of our country's deficits and the size of the unfunded entitlements, the United States government is, in fact, insolvent. The United States is inflating its currency like crazy, and it's only going to get worse until we go through a hyperinflation. Every trick in the book will be used to make sure that the masses of people continue holding the government's paper money that promises to always buy less and less and less. Sticking in a productivity tax through hedonic adjustment is a cute trick, But as a saver or as an investor, you shouldn't fall for that. Now, this comes from Kitco. It's a short article put out by Richard Benson. Go to www.kitco.com. That's www.kitco.com for the Richard Benson Report. Now, Benson is just one of many reports that you'll see on the Kitco webpage. Now, there's another guy that writes these conservative newsletters. I quote from him quite often. In fact, I subscribe to his newsletter. It's $130 a year. His name is Bob Chapman. He lives down in a place called Punta Gorda, Florida. He's probably the biggest, best, and maybe the best known of the underground newsletter writers. He puts out a newsletter here. It's twice a week, Wednesday and Saturday morning, comes over the email. And it's about 20 pages. So I figured that if you get 20 pages and you do that times 100 days or 100 issues a year, you get about 2,000 pages for $130 a year. So 130, that'd be 130, be 1,300 cents, wouldn't it? 1,300 cents. No, it's more than that. It's 130 times 100 equals 13,000 cents. That's what happens when you go to public school. So let's take 13,000 cents and divide that by 2,000. And it's around 6.5 cents a page. 6.5 cents a page for real information, I think, is a real value. Now, this other that I just read to you from Benson, Richard Benson, here's free. It was a 3-page article here, and it came from Kitco, didn't cost you anything. And it told you a little piece of the story about hedonic adjustments. It's just another modality by which government steals from all of us. They lie to us and then steal from us. And then we go to the polls and vote them back into office, which in law says that you and I are the proximate cause of our own injury. That's why I contend that it's probably about time. At least it's time for me. I can't speak for you, but it's about time for me to quit participating in my own robbery and my own demise. So I thought I'd do something a little different. Now, the International Forecaster is one of those publications, similar to Benson here, that tells you what's going on in the real world. When you listen to CBS and NBC, they tell you about inflation running at 3%. It's a lie. Inflation is running at 10.9%. 10.9. I took a look at the price of gasoline here the other day. Now, remember, during the election cycle, starting about last September, October, November, the price of gasoline went from $3 down to $2, at least here in my local area, went down by about, one-third. Now, the last time I was at the gas station, I noticed that it was back up to $2.77. So it's gone up 77 cents. Let's see, this is April, so in the last 6 months since the election, it's gone up 77 cents. It's gone up just about that same one-third. Now, they engineered it down for the election to make me feel good so I'd vote for Republicans, and then the natural marketplace, $60 a barrel oil, produces $3 a gallon gas. So, as long as the price of oil is at around $60 a barrel, 60 to 70, along in that range in there, our gasoline's going to be around $3 a gallon, you know, $3, $3.25, something like that. Which isn't all that bad, adjusted for inflation. Back in 1950, we were paying 27.5 cents a gallon for gas and working for $1.75 an hour. Today, we're working for $16.57 an hour and paying $3 a gallon for gas, adjusted for inflation. The price of gas is roughly the same as it was in 1950 at $3 a gallon, except that the tax that we're now paying, that income tax, do you remember that? Back in 1950, you were making $3,000 a year, and today you're making $40,000 a year. Let's just see what that is. $16.57 was the last number I saw. And let's just multiply that times 8 hours a day, and that gives us about $132 a day. So if we're making $132 a day, and we're going to work about 2,000 hours a year. So let me take 2,000 hours times 1657. You'd be making $33,140 a year. You know, if you're working in a factory someplace and getting $16 an hour. That $33,000 a year is about 10 times more than you were making back in 1950. But back in 1950, we weren't paying 17% income tax. And while the total tax rate, the top tax rate was 91%, that was for wealthy people. And they had tax deductions. Local guys like us, little guys like us, paid little or no income tax. We paid a little Social Security tax. I think it was $84 a year out of our $3,000. Today, you're paying around $7,600 a year. Now, you know, when you're paying those kind of taxes, that productivity gain that we've made over all these years in real dollars, real purchasing power dollars, have gone down. And that's why our economists are telling us, you know, we haven't had any real wage increases since 1973. And as a result of that, we now have our women working. And over 50% of the women in the country are out in the workplace, along with all the rest of us out there. And we're living poorer today in 2007 than we were in 1950. Now, tuck that one away in your heart. And the reason for that is because our government's lying to us and stealing from us. And the number one way that they're stealing from us is through these hedonic adjustments. For instance, last year, when they passed out the Social Security inflation or cost of living index increases, it was 3.4%. They said, well, inflation went up 3.4%. So all of you Social Security people out there, you said, well, that's really good of our government, and God bless the third rail of politics, Social Security. And you took your 3.4% and you went to the store and you spent it. But the real prices in the store went up 10.9%. So you got 3.4% more money and 10% higher prices, which means that you had a net loss of around 7%. Can you follow that? So you got 7% less goods for the same amount of money that you were spending the year before. So you took a 7% cut in your standard of living. Now that's the real government. There's another tax out there which is called the Alternative Minimum Tax, the AMT, Alternative Minimum Tax. It was designed by Congress some years back to make sure that the fat cats paid some tax, that they didn't get away without paying anything. That alternative minimum tax now hits the middle class Americans harder than the original income tax that George Bush reduced for you. Do you remember that? So here's the Republicans that came in 2000. And then they said, well, we're going to give you a tax cut. Boy, that's popular. That's what I wanted to hear, tax cut. So they gave us a tax cut and then saddled us with the AMT, and the AMT, the alternative minimum tax, now takes more than the taxes we were paying in 2000 as a percentage of income. Bush and the Republicans did not give us a tax cut. They gave us a tax increase. That's the bottom line. So while they were advertising tax reduction, they were actually raising our taxes. And while they're telling us that we're living better and that inflation is 3.4%, they're lying to us, and it's 10.9%. And the guys that are reporting this are these newsletter writers like Benson and and the international forecaster here, Bob Chapman. Now, that's just two, and over the last couple of days, I've been reading to you several of these news articles and telling you about inflation and telling you about what's going on out here in the real world. We'll do a little more of that right after this break. Let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's eight schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you want more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. And that's because most of the authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about current events. In the International Forecaster, we read about U.S. markets. Now, we've heard a lot about real estate and the real estate boom. And even on the mainstream press, they're telling us about the price declines and the housing bubble that has burst. But nobody tells you how bad it is or what the real numbers are from Boston, Massachusetts to Phoenix, Arizona, and from Seattle, Washington to Houston, Texas, any better than Bob Chapman does in the International Forecaster. He says real estate and equity price inflation have driven two-thirds of the increase in household net worth over the past 10 years. They now are even more important today, more important than ever. Since 1980, household leverage as a percentage of gross domestic product has doubled, after remaining relatively constant in the prior quarter century. This leveraging of household real estate assets has been the method to continue and the continued net worth acceleration and gross domestic product growth dependent household consumption patterns. If households stopped leveraging their balance sheets, both real estate and consumption would fall. Now, this brings us to the current state of real estate and the consumption. Will the contraction in lending in real estate due to the excesses in the subprime area lead to a change of direction? And the answer is yes. The effort to save the American economy, which began in 2001, has finally come full circle and the Ponzi scheme is coming unraveled. The overextension of credit, outrageously low interest rates, and loans to totally unqualified buyers have now come home to roost. The subprime and the ALTA markets speak for themselves, as does the failure of 50 of the nation's largest subprime lenders. And there is nothing contained about the subprime problem, and the worst is yet to come. And it will haunt the housing sector and the entire credit market for at least another 2.5 years. And we haven't had downgrades in the CDOs as yet. Spreads are just now widening in the junk bonds, and the better quality mortgages are already being corrupted. As these downgrades come, and the downside will feed on itself because many institutional investors cannot hold paper of less than investment grade. Now, the Federal Reserve may be responsible for a 3-year binge of money and credit creation of over 10% a year, but there is another 4% annualized that is created outside of the Federal Reserve system. Now that means that the Federal Reserve is no longer in total control of the credit cycle. Private credit market operators will be running for the hills, and they really controlled lending in the mortgage market. Deleveraging has already begun, and it will be expensive, especially in this sector. Hedge funds bought 60% of the ALTA and subprime paper. And these hedge funds are leveraged to the eyeballs. The rest of the buyers have been pension funds, institutional investors, insurance companies, large investment banks, and other carry trade players. Subprime funding has all but disappeared already. And that can be called nothing but credit contraction. And all of these professional investors have been caught offside, and in addition, the hedge funds are coming under fire from regulators in London, of all places. And these pros know that the subprime problem will spread, so they have to be lightening up in their leveraged positions. This is not what the Federal Reserve and the other central banks want. They will have to find a way to entice these speculators to reassume and resume their former highly leveraged positions. And the only way that we can see that being done is by further increasing money and credit, which brings on more inflation and leads to hyperinflation in the near future. This said, the private credit markets have to be watched closely as well. Spreads have widened in the CDOs and junk bonds, which has pushed yields higher. Another key will be deleveraging in the emerging debt and equity markets. Charts show a possible head and shoulders forming, and unfortunately, the formation could take at least 18 months. More months to complete. That said, we will have to look for net long-term erosion and the widening of bond spreads. Another sector to watch is the foreign inflow of funds into U.S. equities. And you can add to that the Shanghai Stock Exchange Index, which is loaded with leveraged funds. The other main markets to watch are Russia, Mexico, Brazil, and India. We believe that when these markets turn down, they will do so in unison. These markets are very overpriced being up to 50% overpriced since last summer. And we don't believe that deleveraging is here with a bang. It will be reduced somewhat slowly. And we'll watch the spreads and the foreign markets and the central bank M3s to see where we're headed. Leverage is going up and horrible coming down. We'll see what develops. Now let me pause here and make my little editorial comment. We've been told over the last 5 or 6 years that the economy is strong. Don't worry about a thing. Everything's great. And we watched the housing bubble, and the bubble expanded. Interest rates went down. Alan Greenspan at the Fed engineered them down to 1%. People went out, bought houses. Housing prices went up. People were buying like mad. Everybody loves a boom, don't they? It's a lot of fun. Now, a new product came out into the marketplace, and these were called ARMs. These are adjustable rate mortgages. That's where you buy this thing with a low rate, you know, 3-4% interest. And people went out and they bought these houses on speculation, and they put nothing down, took an adjustable rate mortgage, started making the payments. They'd make payments for 6 months, and then they would turn the house over. They'd sell it because it was constantly rising in value. So they'd buy it for $200,000, sell it for $220,000, and they'd make $20,000 in 6 months. Boy, that's wonderful. That's a heck of a neat deal. So the guy that bought it for $220,000, he kept it for 6 months and sold it for $240,000. The guy that bought it for $240,000, he kept it for 6 months and sold it for $260,000. And this went on, and everything's going great. This is a great way to make money, isn't it? Nobody told these people, evidently, that at some point in time it reaches critical mass. You get to the top, and then it starts going down. When it gets to the top, let's pick a top at around $300,000. And then you buy it for $300,000, and of course you expect to sell it for $320,000. But a reversal in the market comes into play, and the value of the house goes from $300,000 down to $280,000. Not only didn't you make your profit, now you bought it for $300,000, it's worth $280,000. You're in a negative position in the house. The house is actually worth less than you owe on it. And now you're making these $2,000 or $3,000 a month payments on this house that's worth less money than when you bought it. What are you going to do now? Now, we have several million homeowners in America in that position. Several million. I think the last number I saw was 6 million. Now, those 6 million people are hurting, and they're going to default, and defaults are going up. And so what Chapman has been reporting on here is the defaults that are increasing. Every week I watch the defaults, and the defaults are going up by 10-15% per month. They're doubling and tripling and quadrupling every year, and have been for the past 2 years. So we go back 2 years, and you know there was 1,000 defaults, and then it doubled to 2,000, it doubled to 4,000. Now, the big banks that issued these mortgages, they put these CDOs out. These are commercial packages of mortgages, and then they sell them to investors from England and Ireland and France and Germany and from Japan and China. And then these people are making their money off of these investments. And these CDOs that you heard him talk about here are going down in value, and now the big banks are unable to sell the CDOs because of the mortgage defaults. You know, people that are investors, you know, they say, well, wait a minute. If the housing market is deflating, and these are packaged mortgages, and these people are defaulting on the mortgages, then the companies that are handling these mortgages are going bankrupt. And that's these subprime lenders, and 50 of them now have gone bankrupt. These are bad omens. Bad omens. In fact, the numbers that are coming out are reminiscent of the Depression years of the 1930s. We haven't seen these kinds of numbers since the 1930s, which is what leads those of us that are old and conservative back to, well, I told you so. Now, we've had a hell of a party since World War II. This party has gone on almost uninterrupted from 1945 through 2005. And as I speak here in 2007, there isn't any sign here that the party is over, except the cracks that we see in the real numbers that aren't being reported by our government. Now, when you have trillions of dollars in hedge funds invested around the world in these kinds of packages, these CDOs, then these hedge funds are leveraged out. Now, leverage, that means, let's take a look at the word leverage here for you. Normally, when you buy a house, you walk in, let's take a $100,000 house, you plunk $20,000 down, that's your down payment, so that you have an equity position of 20% in the house. Now, when the value of the house goes down by 10%, you still have 10%. So it gives you an incentive to keep the house and keep making the payments and keep the house up and keep making repairs on it, because you've got some positive equity in here. Now, let's leverage this house. Let's suppose that I offered you a house and I said, listen, I'll let you into this $100,000 house for $10,000 now. So $10,000 then will get you a $100,000 house. Well, with the same $20,000, you can buy two of these houses. So when you take your $20,000 and you buy two houses for $10,000 down each, this is called leverage. You're able to take your $20,000 capital and buy two houses instead of one. Let's suppose that we cut it down to $5,000. Well, now your $20,000 capital will leverage you into four houses. What if we give you no money down? Well, now, depending upon your credit and your ability to make the payments, we might be able to get eight houses. Then people started doing that. With very little down, you can leverage yourself into more houses. Now, this is wonderful. If you're buying a house for $200 and selling it for $220, you're making a $20,000 profit. If you can buy two houses for $200 and you can sell them for a $20,000 profit, you make $40,000. And if you can buy four houses and you can make $20 each on four, you make $80,000. Isn't this leverage wonderful? Hey, this making money never got to be any simpler than that. All right, now by the time you get it up to $300,000 and the value of the house goes down, now let's try it this way. By now you've got eight houses that you bought for $300,000 and you put no money down. And you're hoping to sell these eight houses for $320,000, but the market goes down to $280,000. Now you've got a negative cash flow, negative asset, and it's 20 times 8. Now you're underwater by $160,000. Can you follow that? Now you've got to finance this $160,000 out of your paycheck, and your paycheck is the same as it's always been. So the leverage then becomes a two-edged sword, and now it's working against you. And that's the bottom line, and that's the problem. Now every week, there's two issues of the International Forecaster come out, and he start off with U.S. markets, and in the U.S. markets, he'll say, well, here's what's going on. It's an economics newsletter, but it's more than an economics newsletter. It's also a newspaper newsletter. There are, in addition to economic information or economic news stories, there's also news stories like corporate crime continues to abound. Joseph Nacio probably used insider knowledge as CEO of Quest Communications to illegally sell $101 million in stock while keeping bad news from investors, says a Massachusetts prosecutor. If convicted, he faces 10 years in prison and $1 million fine on each of the 42 counts of insider trading against him. Now, that's a neat little news item there, just one paragraph. So I'm going to put a bracket around there, and I'm going to make my comment. We have a law here in Anglo-Saxon administration that prohibits unjust weights and balances, prohibits theft. It says, thou shalt not steal, and you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. Now, we Americans decided that those laws no longer applied. After all, we go to church and our preachers over here tell us that these laws that we got from Moses many, many years ago are no longer valid. They're no longer applicable in modern times. I'm not quite sure how theft changes over time, but somehow or another it has. Now, people have been out here investing in these commercial papers, haven't they? And when the value of the commercial paper goes up, they make money. When the value of the commercial paper goes down, they lose money. And in the process of this loss over here, that's bad, they don't like that. In the process of going up, they like that, that feels real good. And it's easy to gamble, it's kind of like a casino. Gambling is fun. If you've never tried it, you ought to try it sometime. It's illegal. I mean, it violates the law of God. But, you know, if you're looking for fun and frolic, you know, you just can't find a better time at Flo's Whorehouse or down at Harrah's Casino. Now, these illegal activities come back to haunt you. And notice here that here's a guy who is being prosecuted for illegally selling $101 million in stock. Now, this guy probably went to the Harvard Business School, where they do not teach the Ten Commandments, where they don't teach thou shalt not steal. And he stole the $101 million from the investors in the company. Now, why are these people investing their money in these paper stocks in this company in the first place when they were told with specificity in Leviticus 19, 35, and 36 not to do that? So, in reality, the people who invest in the stock market are in violation of the Mosaic Law. And as a result of that, they make themselves the target of a theft by an insider trading, which we have been hearing a lot about over the last 5 or 6 years now, haven't we? Have you noticed Enron, insider trading, bankruptcy, losses, paper losses? People who invested their money in gold and silver and real estate or in wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. And when I say invested in real estate, I meant you bought the house and you paid for it and you own it. It's free and clear. Let's try a $100,000 house just for funsies, children. If you've got a house for $100,000 that's bought and paid for and you own it, the only expenses you have on it then are the taxes and upkeep. It's a $100,000 house and the value of real estate goes down by 50%. There's no leverage. You own the house. You had a $100,000 house last week. This week it's worth $50,000. You still have the same $50,000, and you don't have any mortgage. You don't have any margin call to meet. You can rent the house and get enough out of it to pay the taxes and the upkeep, and your asset stays intact. Now, isn't that a better way to do business than by leverage and by false weights or unjust weights and balances like mortgages, interest, margin calls, and inflation? I was at my class reunion the last time, about 5 years ago now, and there was a young fellow in there. He's an old man now. When I knew him, he was a young fellow in the ninth grade. His name was Henry. And Henry wasn't the sharpest marble in the drawer, at least not in the ninth grade. At least that was our perception of Henry, because he was 2 years behind in school. 2 years behind. See, he should have been a junior, and he was in my freshman class when I was a freshman in high school. And so naturally, we looked at Henry and we thought, well, now Henry over here, he's not the brightest kid here in the class. And he wasn't. I remember in English class, you know, he was just barely getting by. He kind of like me, you know, just barely getting by, but I wasn't behind 2 years. I was up to grade level, but, you know, and so time went on, and, you know, graduation comes, and then time passes. Well, I hadn't seen Henry, you know, for about 40 years. And so I happened to be at the class reunion. I think it was the 40th, maybe it was 10 years ago, you know, you get to be old, time passes.
And so here's old Henry there, and I saw this big tall kid. Henry was a big tall kid. He was about 6 foot six. 6'4", 6'6", something. He was a big tall kid. Hell, he was a big tall kid in the ninth grade. And when I saw this big tall guy over there that I had to look up to, I went over and I said, "Are you Henry Moore?" And he said, "Yeah, I'm Henry Moore." And so I said, "Well, I'm George Gordon." He said, "Oh, yeah, I remember you, George." Now, we hadn't seen each other for 40 years, you know, or more. So we went over to the bar, and we're having a drink, and we're chit-chatting a little bit. And I said, "Well, bring me up to speed. Henry, what have you been doing?" He says, "Well, I've been building houses." He says, "I'm an electrician. I'm retired now." He retired that year. And so he, over the years, he'd take his money, and he would buy a lot there in Eureka, California, and he would build a house on it. He was an electrician, you know, day to day, and then he made a little money, and so he'd build a house, and come to find out he now has 7 houses. He has 1 house he lives in and 6 rentals. He owns them all free and clear. Now, I was talking to my buddy David up there, and David said that his house out on Myrtle Avenue was worth $236,000. So I got to thinking, gee, $236,000, and David's house ain't anything to brag about, you know. $236,000 times 7. That's $1,652,000. And Henry's got 6 of these houses rented. So he's making an income off of these 6 houses. Now, of course, he's still got his Social Security, and he's still got his union pension. And then he's got 6 houses over here that he's got rented out. He owns all 7 of them. He's not making any payments on the house he lives in. I'd say old Henry over here, for being the class clown or the class dummy back in the ninth grade with Mrs. Denbo, did pretty well for himself. Did better than I did. Did better than anybody else that I know of in the class. And he followed a very simple principle. Just weights and balances. No credit. All cash. The guy's a millionaire. Not quite the kind of millionaire that he would have been in 1950 when $1 million was $1 million. But shucks, kids, even $1 million today is quite a chunk of change, wouldn't you say? Now that's the benefits of practicing thou shalt not steal. And this old guy, Henry Moore, is taking the benefits from practicing thou shalt not steal, and you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. I'll tuck that one away in your heart for a moment, and we'll take a break here, and we'll be right back with another program tomorrow night. Same time, same station, so let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and the law hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that's open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And if you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.